Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello, and welcome to As It Is, a free, daily 30-minute program designed to help you learn everyday American English. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz at the Voice of America's Learning English branch in Washington. Today on the program, we tell you about a group that helps young people do everything from learn how to wash their clothes to succeed in high school. We'll talk with volunteers and the teenagers they are helping in the Eastern American city of Baltimore, Maryland.
It doesn't feel like volunteering. It feels like Trey is someone I know and care about.
Then you will hear Jonathan Evans' technology report. You've heard of Silicon Valley, the place in Northern California where Google, Apple, and other technology industry leaders are headquartered. But have you heard about Silicon Beach in Southern California? You will today.
We have a focus on interactive and on content.
And as always, we will present The Making of a Nation. Every day here at VOA Learning English, we bring you news from and about America and the world. And we tell you the often surprising and always interesting history of the United States. We are a little different here at VOA Learning English because we exist to help you learn everyday American English. We speak a little slower than normal, and we use words that are easy to understand. Listen to the program, then practice saying the words and sentences the way we do. It's a free and easy way to improve your American English skills every day of the year. We're on the radio, on the web, and we come to you on a podcast. We are wherever you are. We're the Voice of America. In the United States, a group called THREAD has been helping young people meet their goals for more than 10 years. The nonprofit organization is based in the eastern city of Baltimore, Maryland. Its volunteers help high school students with almost anything, like learning how to wash their clothes and how to get a job. Some volunteers drive students to school and help them with difficult classes. They even spend time with the young people on weekends. THREAD says it is helping to create families that are not connected by blood.
All right, so click on that. Let's just start over and see if we can figure this out. You know how to do that? Double click.
Completing paperwork for admission to college is not easy, but 18-year-old Trey is getting help from Brenda Wilson, a volunteer at THREAD.
Now, we've all been frustrated with filling out forms and passwords and getting kicked back and forth.
Ms. Wilson is a former teacher and lawyer. She has been advising Trey for almost 2 years.
He just graduated high school and is trying to set his goals and figure out what to do next.
Ms. Wilson says she also talks with Trey about how he is going to vote, how he spends his time, and what he likes to do. Trey says working with Ms. Wilson has taught him that sometimes he must do things he does not like doing.
I ain't like working on computers, but she helped me to get out of it. Like you're going to have to learn.
Ms. Wilson says she likes being involved with Trey.
It doesn't feel like volunteering. It feels like Trey is someone I know and care about, like I would for someone in my family.
Thread says it is working to create the kinds of deep relationships that Trey and Ms. Wilson have developed. The group wants students to feel that they are understood, cared for, and appreciated. Thread was launched 11 years ago. It was the idea of Sarah Heminger, who was a student at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine. The school and the hospital are in a poor neighborhood in Baltimore. Ms. Heminger wanted to do something to help young people from poor neighborhoods. She wanted to give poor students the advice and support they needed to succeed in school and in life. Thread now has 207 student alumni and more than 750 volunteers. Thread helps connect students who are having difficulty in high school with people who can help them change their lives. It says some of the students have a parent who is incarcerated, or the students themselves may be jailed at some point during their time with Thread. They may have struggles with their attendance at school, or something bad is happening at home. Thread says it stays with the students no matter what happens. It never gives up on them. The relationships between the students and volunteers are planned to last for 10 years. The volunteers give the young people whatever kind of help they need. This might include giving the student a ride home from school or helping them with relationships. The group also helps students meet with experts to learn the skills they need to get a summer job or a permanent one. Kiss was 15 years old when she joined the program 3 years ago.
I had a lot of problems. When I moved up here, I didn't know a lot of people because I don't have family here. And so when they came into my life, they helped me with everything.
Kiss must complete one more year of high school before she can go to college. She already knows what she wants to do with her life. She says she wants to be a dentist and she wants to volunteer at Thread. She has been helped by Jesse Cohen, a medical student at Johns Hopkins. He says helping Kiss has helped him.
Kiss has taught me a lot about perseverance. She has overcome numerous obstacles to get where she is today, which is really inspiring.
Now it's time for our weekly look at the latest technology news. America's high technology industry is centered in Northern California, in an area that has become known as Silicon Valley. It is not far from the city of San Francisco. Silicon Valley is where Google, Apple, and other industry leaders are headquartered. But smaller tech startups can be found further south in and around the city of Los Angeles. Some people are now calling this area Silicon Beach. Our technology correspondent Jonathan Evans tells us more.
The company Ventana is one of the many technology startups near Los Angeles. The company's name comes from the Spanish word for window. It is based in the seaside community of Santa Monica. Ventana creates holograms, three-dimensional images for education, marketing, and entertainment. Ashley Crowder works for the company.
It takes two people less than an hour to set up the screen and can be shipped anywhere in the world.
The system is interactive, requiring communication between people and computers. It can produce live remote appearances from sometimes distant, faraway places and virtual computer-aided concerts. Users are able to control the projected images with hand movements. Ventana makes use of its closeness to Hollywood, the home of America's movie industry. Ben Conway also works for the company. He says Silicon Valley is more concerned about technology, while Silicon Beach deals with entertainment.
We have a focus on interactive and on content, and that's something that the entertainment community really understands.
But the technology sector is diverse. Matthew Goldman is with Wallaby Financial. His company advises people on which credit cards to use based on interest rates and awards from the stores they visit. Mr. Goldman says the company has designed application software for wireless phones.
The phone locates you and communicates with our servers that make up these recommendations and do the intelligence and send back the results to your phone in virtually real time.
The Los Angeles tech industry spreads from the city to surrounding communities and the Pacific Ocean. Experts say its size is hard to measure. But Silicon Beach is home to many hundreds of tech startups and continues to grow.
Thanks, Jonathan. That's our program for today. We hope it has informed and entertained you and has helped you learn everyday American English. The Making of a Nation is coming up next. VOA began producing The Making of a Nation in 1969. At one time, it was heard weekly, then twice a week. But now, you can hear it Monday through Friday here on The Voice of America. It tells about the social changes, events, documents, and personalities that shaped the United States and helped it have an influence on world history. And it explains the reasons the country's leaders made their decisions. We want to hear what interests you. Tell us what you want to hear about. Our email address is learningenglish@voanews.com. That's learningenglish@voanews.com. And please know this, we read every message you send us. I'm Christopher Jones Cruz at the VOA Learning English headquarters in Washington. We'll be back tomorrow at this same time to help you learn everyday American English with another broadcast, webcast, and podcast edition of As It Is from The Voice of America.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English. Thank you.
VOA Learning English. Welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. In 1796, the new nation held its third presidential election. George Washington won the first two elections without opposition. But 1796 saw a change in American politics. That year, for the first time, there was more than one candidate for president. There was also more than one political party. The Federalists were led by former Treasury Secretary Alexander Hamilton, and the Republicans were led by former Secretary of State Thomas Jefferson. John Adams was a Federalist. Most people expected him to win. He was well known throughout the country. He had campaigned for American independence from Britain. He had served as a diplomat in Europe and as the first American minister to Britain. He was George Washington's choice for vice president and had served in that position for both of Washington's terms. But unlike other Federalists, Adams was not loyal to Alexander Hamilton. So Hamilton worked against Adams. Hamilton tried to win support for his own candidate for president. His choice was another Federalist named Thomas Pinckney from South Carolina. At last, the day arrived for counting the votes of the electors. The Federalists were shocked by the results. 71 electors voted for John Adams. 68 voted for Thomas Jefferson. Only 60 voted for Hamilton's choice, Thomas Pinckney. Under the electoral system used at that time, the candidate with the most electoral votes became president. The candidate with the next largest number of votes became vice president. So America's second president would be John Adams, a Federalist, and his vice president would be Thomas Jefferson, a Republican. Jefferson had resigned from public service a few years earlier, but he decided to accept his election as vice president. He wrote to his friend James Madison that he was willing to serve under Adams. Jefferson said he believed Adams was the only man who could stop Alexander Hamilton from becoming president in the next election in 1800. To Adams himself, Jefferson wrote that he valued their long friendship and hoped it would continue. Republican newspapers carried articles that were friendly to Federalist John Adams, the first time they had done so. Adams and Jefferson took office in March 1797. However, some Federalists believed their party's power had come to an end. Adams was a Federalist, but, as we said, he was not loyal to the party's leader, Alexander Hamilton. Hamilton, sitting in his law office in New York City, did not lose hope. He knew he still controlled the top Federalist leaders in Congress. More than that, he believed he knew how to control John Adams. The new president made Hamilton's job easy. Adams kept George Washington's top advisors. The three men who had served in Washington's cabinet would now advise President Adams. Washington had appointed them at Hamilton's request, and they always did what Hamilton told them to do. Historians still cannot explain why John Adams, a man who did not like or trust Alexander Hamilton, kept the three cabinet secretaries. If the secretaries had been men of great ability, then that might be an explanation. but they were not. One was a Secretary of State who knew very little about foreign relations. The second was a Secretary of the Treasury who knew even less about finance. And the third was a Secretary of War who knew nothing about military matters and defense. Adams may have kept these men as an act of party unity, or he may have kept them because he could not get anyone else. Whatever his reason, the decision was politically costly for Adams. The three cabinet secretaries worked together against him. President Adams would tell his cabinet secretaries what he wanted. Then they would secretly go to Alexander Hamilton for their orders. In the end, these secret activities helped destroy the Federalist Party. They also made the administration of John Adams one of the most important periods in the political history of the United States. John Adams was born in the village of Braintree, Massachusetts, in 1735. He wanted to be a farmer, but he was sent to Harvard College to study to be a clergyman. He had no interest in that career and became a lawyer instead. In the years before the American Revolution, John Adams wrote articles about the injustice of British rule. He also became a delegate to the First Continental Congress. He urged the Congress to appoint George Washington as commander-in-chief of the colonial armies. He argued for the creation of a navy, and he helped develop the resolutions declaring America's independence.
We think of George Washington in his famous farewell address urging Americans to give their loyalty to the United States, to further its interest and not to be loyal to some foreign country. And that was what Adams believed as well.
John Ferling is a professor emeritus of history at the University of West Georgia. He has written many books about America's founders, including John Adams. He says Adams wanted Americans to be able to govern themselves through their representatives.
Adams was opposed to monarchies, and he was opposed to rule by hereditary nobility.
Adams spent most of the Revolutionary War years in Europe. He helped win Dutch recognition of the new American nation. He also negotiated a loan from the Dutch government, as well as a treaty of friendship and commerce. After the Americans defeated British forces, he helped negotiate the peace treaty between the two countries. Then he served as the first American minister to Britain. Adams was extremely intelligent and was a thoughtful, lively writer. However, John Ferling says, Adams often acted very coldly and said little, or he easily became angry.
If you thought of adjectives to describe Adams, certainly you would think of words like captious, contrary, gruff, egotistical, short-tempered, whatever.
But he says many people liked Adams after they got to know him.
He was certainly an excellent conversationalist, and he was filled with ideas, and he wasn't a vindictive person. He seemed to be a very honest person.
His best friend was probably his wife, Abigail. They were married for almost 60 years. Joseph Ellis, a history professor at Mount Holyoke College, wrote a book about their relationship.
They're the first power couple in American history. She has greater influence on policy than any first lady up until perhaps Eleanor Roosevelt.
Joseph Ellis says Abigail Adams did not see herself mainly as a hostess, even though she did lead social events. Instead, he says, the Adamses were a diplomatic team. Another of John Adams' supporters was Thomas Jefferson. This was strange. Jefferson's political philosophy was opposed to everything Adams represented, and the two men did argue, but they were also friends. For the last years of their lives, Adams and Jefferson wrote letters to each other about their memories and about the future of the country. Perhaps Jefferson liked Adams because he respected him for his intelligence. Perhaps he never forgot that Adams had fought hard for American independence. Adams had given many years of his life to the young nation. However, some people just did not like John Adams, but they knew they needed to work with him. Federalist leaders especially appealed to Adams' weaknesses when they wanted his support. For example, they knew Adams was jealous of George Washington. Sometimes, if Adams knew Washington's opinion on a subject, he would purposely offer a different opinion. Yet Washington, like Jefferson, respected Adams. He felt the new nation needed Adams' skills. And John Furling says Adams also respected George Washington, even though he thought Washington was not always fair to him. Adams' last public appearance was before cadets from the United States Military Academy at West Point. He was a very old man by then. Someone had to help him walk. And, says historian John Furling, Adams could not say more than a few sentences.
But what he did in that speech was he exhorted those would-be officers to model themselves on George Washington. And called Washington a great man.
Adams' personal weaknesses caused other troubles during his presidency. He belonged to the Federalist Party, but he did not want to become involved in party arguments. And he did not want to make all the compromises necessary in the world of politics. So other Federalists often worked against him. Adams won the presidency in 1796, but his term would be difficult. His own party, the Federalists, did not trust him, and he did not have the support of the general public. The people knew he believed that men of money and position should govern America. Even so, Adams did not expect the job of president to be easy. In politics, he said, a man must always walk on broken glass and red-hot iron. It is not easy to do this when you're not wearing shoes, but some men must do it. There are many dangerous things that have to be done for our country in these dangerous times. If nobody else will do them, he said, he will. I'm Steve Ember.